Well, hey everyone, it's Nate here. Happy New Year. Welcome to 2021. Wow. We not only made it through the toughest year of many of our lives, and certainly the most surreal, but I think we're stronger, hopefully wiser, and in a much better state to move forward. Thanks everyone for tuning in. If this is your first time listening to the Vinyl Guide podcast, I want to welcome you. Grab a drink from the fridge. Make yourself comfortable. Kick up your feet. This is episode 254 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast where we talk all about records, vinyl, rare recordings, and more. And I think you'll all enjoy today's conversation with Mr. Lenny Kaye, longtime collaborator with Patti Smith, songwriter, producer, and, well, you guessed it, record collector. Lenny has been such a music fanatic since his youth. Not only has he spent his life cultivating this marvelous record collection, but Lenny was even tapped on the shoulder from Elektra's Jack Holtzman to create the compilation Nuggets, which is noted as one of the most influential compilation albums ever, one that helped spawn punk rock as we know it, and a record that is still desirable and relevant to this very day. Now today we talk to Lenny all about that compilation, the early self-funded records with Patti Smith, his record collection, and heaps more. And I'm sure you'll all agree, Lenny is such a cool guy. I think you'll all enjoy this conversation. Now recently, Lenny wrote the foreword to a fantastic book for record collectors called Mind Over Matter, The Myths and Mysteries of Detroit's Fortune Records. Now this is a tremendous book. It's all about this highly influential record label, Fortune Records, and we recently had an episode all on this label, episode 253. Go back if you want to hear more, or just Google Mind Over Matter, Fortune Records. You'll find the book online. It is a tremendous read, a must for record nerds, and something I know you'll enjoy for years to come. That's Mind Over Matter, The Myths and Mysteries of Detroit's Fortune Records, available now. By the way, there is more Lenny available. That's right, we have an extended version of today's interview with Lenny Kaye, available only to our Patreon supporters at patreon.com/vinylguide. Join our Patreon community, you get extra stuff, early episodes, extended interviews, and more. We even arranged our Patreon community free passes to the Melvins TV New Year's Eve streaming event. That was absolutely awesome. I hope everyone enjoyed it, and those are the sort of things we're going to do more in the future. So join us up there, patreon.com/vinylguide. Enjoy the extras, extended interviews, and hear more of our conversation with Lenny Kaye. And I should also say that we are brought to you in part today by the Groove Washer Record Cleaner, the best record cleaner on earth. I use the Groove Washer multiple times each day. I even just got gifted one of those vacuum record cleaning machines, one of those really nice, expensive ones, yet I still use the Groove Washer. That Groove Washer G2 fluid they make is perfect for record maniacs or hobbyists. Whatever level you're at in terms of your record collection, ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store or go to groovewasher.com. Use promo code VINYLGUIDE10 for a discount and get the world's best record cleaner shipped directly to you. That's groovewasher.com, promo code VINYLGUIDE10. And we are also brought to you today by AudiophileUSA.com. AudiophileUSA.com sells only excellent and near mint vinyl records. There are no regrets when you get a record from AudiophileUSA.com. They are perfect, or as close to perfect as you'll find anywhere. Plus, they ship worldwide, so head over to AudiophileUSA.com and don't just look at the main page, but search and dig and explore their site. Heaps of great deals at AudiophileUSA.com. Over 42,000 titles in stock. You could search by label, by genre, and find those records on your hit list and more. That's AudiophileUSA.com. Go there now and find your holy grail. And finally, if you like Lenny, Patti, and these type of conversations, check out some of our other episodes we've had on the Vinyl Guide podcast, interviews including episode 253, The Rise and Fall of Fortune Records, episode 251 with world-famous record collector John Tefteller, episode 242 with Thurston Moore of Sonic Youth talking all about a lifetime of record collecting, Episode 222, The Story of the Beatles Butcher Cover with Beatles historian Bruce Spizer. Episode 206 with Sub Pop Records co-founder Bruce Pavitt. Episode 138 with Dr. Dennis Tech of Radio Birdman. And heaps more. Hundreds of episodes available wherever you get your podcasts. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Sonnet. Subscribe to The Vinyl Guide and enjoy those episodes and more. And now with the upfronts done, let's get into today's conversation with Mr. Lenny Kaye. Hello. Mr. Lenny Kaye, how are you?
How are you doing? I'm trying to get you up on the actual viewing thing. Share screen, is that the one? I'm there.
There you are.
Hey, Nate. Hey. Hey, Nate, how's it going?
Good to see you, man. You're in New York right now?
I'm in East Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, in the Poconos by the Delaware Water Gap, where I mostly live, actually, at this point in time.
Got it. All right. Yeah. Well, I'm on probably the exact opposite end of the earth down here in Sydney, Australia.
Oh my God. That's crazy. Technology is beautiful. We were supposed to be in Australia last April, and now we've been postponed till I think next March or something like that. But to be honest, I'd be amazed if we got down there.
That'd be pretty rough. Right now, they're being very, very picky on who they're letting in the country. And once you get in the country, you have to sit in a hotel for 2 weeks while you quarantine.
No way can a band, you know, there's no, you know, unless they're giving you a huge amount of money. But, you know, nobody wants to sit. I wouldn't mind sitting in Sydney. I mean, that's not a bad place, but. What can you do?
Well, they put you up in like the Four Seasons, so it's not a completely bad existence, but yeah, it'd be pretty boring after a couple of days.
Well, you know, I have a very good inner life. I'm sure there's a couple. I can't go out to the record stores there. Oh, well, what can you do?
Well, let's start there. When you travel, are record stores kind of part of the itinerary?
Well, you know, it's my relaxation when I travel. When I get to a town and I have a day off, and you know, I always look around and see, especially in Europe, where the record store is, and I'll go and sit outside it and smoke a joint, and then go in and play in the fields of the Lord. I'm not looking for anything specific now. Mm-hmm. I have more than I will ever listen to for the remainder of my existence. But on the other hand, it's kind of just fun to look around, see what's there, see if there's anything. Some weird tangent that I happen to be on, some niche genre. You know, you never know. It's a way that I like to relax, basically.
Yeah, I always tell people it's like my golf game. Some people play golf. I run around to record stores.
Yeah, you know, and it's kind of fun. I always try to leave a few dollars at the record store because especially independent record stores need a little love, and that's what I'm about. But to be honest, really, I like the atmosphere, I like the camaraderie, and I like the chance that I might like find something that will amuse me and maybe even become a part of the music I make. You never can tell.
Now, when you walk into a record store, what's your routine? Do you start looking at the wall? Do you go to new arrivals? What do you do?
I like new arrivals. I always ask them if they got a rare box because that's where they'll put the best stuff. And I don't like to spend a lot of money on records because, you know, unless it's something I'm insane about, but, you know, I just like to see what they got.
What got you into collecting records? You started as a kid, yeah?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I started when I was really 12. I bought my first records when I was almost at my 12th birthday in 1958. My first records were Sheb Woolley's Purple People Eater, Tommy Edwards, you know, It's All in the Game. Conway Twitty's It's Only Make Believe, a version of To Know Him, To Love Him by Kathy Carr, because I didn't know that there were other versions. And that's when I started collecting. But I always loved music. I was always into it. And I found it a fascinating thing. I'm tuned into the top 40. Mm. And, you know, as soon as I got a record player in the shape of a conga drum, of all things, I started accumulating records.
Did you have a job that helped paid for this? I mean, was there enough money to be able to buy records regularly?
I was in high school, but, you know, I wouldn't eat lunch so I could save my money. Very early on, I got into Group Harmony Records. That was in the early 60s, that was my obsession. And with a couple other friends of mine, you know, we'd go travel up to Newark. I was living in New Brunswick, New Jersey at the time. And we'd travel up to Newark and go around all the record stores and, you know, just find great records. You know, then, of course, when the Beatles came out and the English Invasion happened, you know, I got really interested in rock and roll bands. I'm from the northeast of the country, so I wasn't really exposed to a lot of rockabilly aside from like Carl Perkins or things like that. So I didn't see much of that. But in the northeast, there was very much street corner groups singing, harmonizing. At one point, I had you know, some ideas that I would be a second tenor in a doo-wop group. But then, you know, I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, and like many others, I saw what my future would be. Little did I know it would still be a future 56 years or whenever, however many years it's been since then.
It was there a single record or song that made you want to play guitar?
I think it was more of a genre. I liked the folk genre. And when I got my first guitar, my uncle loaned me an acoustic. I went down to Bleecker Street and walked into Izzy Young's Folklore Center and bought volume 3 of The Best of Sing Out. And I opened it up and I learned how to play Gotta Travel On, Billy Grammer's song. Gee, you know, and then you spend about 5 minutes trying to get the C in there and then another 5 minutes D. But I learned that. And so, you know, for a long time, I was going to be a lonely folk singer in the backyard. But, you know, when the Beatles came, I went electric. So there was nothing specific. I mean, I always had kind of dreams of being in a band, but seeing the Beatles and all the English Invasion groups gave me a template for how to be in a band. And by November of 64, actually just about 3 days ago, I celebrated my 56 band anniversary, November 7th, the Vandals at Chi Psi Fraternity at Rutgers, where I was going. And, you know, I never thought I'd be doing it half century in the future. If I would have known that I would be still playing music, I might have learned to read music. But, you know, it was just something I liked to do. And then when I did the Lynn Cromwell Crazy Like a Fox single, courtesy of my uncle, Larry Cusick, who called up his nephew and asked him to sing Eve of Destruction over the telephone. And when I passed the audition, he brought me in the studio, and him and this guy, Richie Adams, who was the lead singer of the Fireflies, you were mine, they had written a folk protest song to kind of jump on the bandwagon. You know, once I had that 45 in my hand, it was a sense that I could do this in some way, shape, or form. I mean, the single was not a hit even remotely, but it gave me a sense of myself as a musician and, you know, local notoriety and, you know, on and on and on and on.
So that was your first time on record?
Yeah, that was my first time.
And what was that again? Sorry, what was the...
Crazy Like a Fox. My moniker was Link Cromwell. I guess they gave it an English spin. It came out on Hollywood Records, which was a subsidiary of Starday Records in Nashville. They bought the master, put it out. It got a newcomer pick of the week in Cashbox. And I heard it once on a radio station out of Allentown, PA. And that was it. But it gave me a sense of myself as a performer, as a musician, as a singer. And even though I didn't really have a sense that I was going to be able to accomplish this, you know, I was also a writer. So I enjoyed writing about music and thinking about it. And, mm-hmm. you know, it all kind of fed into who I am this very day.
Now, in the early 70s, it sounds like there was this amalgamation of interests that were coming together for you. There was the writing, the the writing about records. Mm-hmm. There was the performing, the playing guitar and writing songs, but there was also your affinity for record collecting, and you even worked in a record store, Village Oldies.
That's that right.
Eventually evolved into Bleecker Bob's. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah. Village Oldies was run by Bleecker Bob and Broadway Al. And I would stop in there, you know, buy a couple records after I'd moved back to New York, I guess around 1968-ish or so. And, you know, I'd go in there and Bob would give me a hard time. He gave everybody a hard time. And one day he says, why don't you work here? I thought, well, that might be fun. And so for $10 a day and all the records I could filch, I worked there for 5 years. I started out 6 days a week. By the time I left, right before Patty's first record came out, Horses, I was down to the Saturday night where I just, you know, go down there for fun. But yeah, I worked there and I was able to see it from the inside and also gather together many of the records mentally that would be on Nuggets, because on Saturday night sometimes I'd have a beer or six and, you know, be my own little disc jockey, you know, in between selling, you know, Beach Boys records or whatever, you know, somebody wanted.
So Village Oldies, it was more of a collectible market, right?
And it wasn't. That's what made Village Oldies great. A lot of the oldies stores, the first one I ever went into was Times Square Records when Slim was there, seeing all those beautiful records on the wall that if I would have had $3, I could have bought records that are worth triple figures today. There was a lot of kind of true oldie stores. There was the House of Oldies. But Village Oldies was different because they not only had the oldies, but they did have newies, I guess, you know, the 60s, you know, progressive rock bands. They sold Fillmore East tickets. So it was a store that wasn't just oldies. It was kind of the history of rock and roll up until that point. You know, we had boxes on the walls, you know, rare blues or, you know, but we sold disco records in a pre-disco era. You know, we had a box that said disco, you know, I don't quite know what was in it, you know, but it was kind of comprehensive, which is more what I'm into. You know, I love oldies, but I also believe that you keep up with the music and the soundtrack of the present. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, a great record's a great record. I mean, it's like Nuggets. To me, Nuggets has lived on, not specifically because it's garage rock, even though, you know, it is, but that I was able to gather 27 great records that even in a weird way transcend the garage genre. They're just great records. And you could do that with reggae. You could do that with girl groups. Any genre has, you know, records that are not just the genre, but a great record. Mm-hmm. And that's the ones I like. And, you know, you can find them with any classification or style that you happen to be into at the time.
So when you started collecting records and you found yourself, I guess, being attracted to more garage rock at the time, what was the leap from collecting those records to starting to work on a compilation that became Nuggets?
Well, I mean, I wasn't so much into garage rock as that's the time when I grew up being in bands. Mm-hmm. You know, my band at the time was The Zoo. We played mostly fraternity circuit, you know, mixers and fraternity houses from Northern Jersey into Pennsylvania, Eastern Pennsylvania. So I was one of those bands. We never really wrote any original material. It was mostly cover versions, R&B, and a whole lot of shaking going on. What did I say with all the verses changed to dirty verses, you know? See that girl from Trenton State? That's where they teach you to masturbate. What did I say? You know, but, and, you know, play shout for 20 minutes and the brothers would, you know, swim in beer on the floor. Four sets a night. So it was a good training ground, but I could feel that there was a lot of energy in these type of bands. We never wrote any original material, but I kind of lived that era. And by living that era, I could relate. You know, I drive around in the car late at night and pull in a station from Buffalo, New York, and hear the Magic Mushrooms is happening. It wasn't being played in New York, but you could pull it in. You could pull in Chicago's WLS. In the summer of 67, I drove across country with my friend Larry Block in a 56 Ford, heading to San Francisco, yeah. And, you know, just listening to the radio all the time, stopping off in a town if I heard a record, asking for it in the record store. A couple of them I left on the back shelf of the car one hot day, and I came back and they were like, woo. You know, but I was just really tuned in, and I really loved, I mean, the 60s, especially for rock and roll, was almost like the Renaissance. You had these incredible artists, I mean, from the Beatles and the Rolling Stones to Jimi Hendrix, Cream, you know, you name it. It was a total explosion of rock and roll at a time when it was moving from being somewhat adolescent teen pop to having pretensions to art. And, you know, even though a lot of the bands were kind of like teen pop if you look back on them, but really, yeah, I kind of lived it. And when I started working for Jack Holzman at Elektra, he hired me as a talent scout because I had appeared, I had just started as a rock writer, and I was, you know, I was writing about cool groups, the Stooges, the Velvets. And thanks to Lillian Roxon, who was writing for the Sydney Morning Herald, great, great journalist and so encouraging to me when I started writing, she kind of manipulated Esquire magazine into putting me in as their token rock critic for their Hot 100 of the music business. And Jack Holzman, whose Elektra label had a lot of very smart bands that rock critics like to write about, the Doors, you know, Love, saw this, and he called me up and he had me come up to the office, and he wanted me to see if I could listen to tapes and find groups. You know, I tried to get him to keep the Stooges for their third album, but didn't have any success. But the one thing he said to me is, I have this idea for a record called Nuggets. And it should be like cuts from those albums that have like one great cut buried. Mm. Like, you know, or maybe there's a hit on the album, but maybe some of the other ones. My feeling has always been that he got one of the first cassette recorders and was wanting to clean out his record collection. He gave me a list of about three or four. One of them was a list from Little Anthony and the Imperials' psychedelic album. So he really didn't have much of a direction, but he wanted to give it to me. And this was kind of, I guess, the end of 1970. And so I worked for them for a few months and, you know, didn't really take anything talent scout wise, but I'd given him a list of 60 songs that I thought would be cool, and obviously spun it a little bit toward the type of band I was in at the time. And I left Elektra. I thought, well, you know, and then they called me up like a few months later and said, we have the rights to all these songs. What should we do? And I thought, well, this project's still on. And, you know, I was a little full of myself. So I kept asking for, let's have a double album. You know, I don't like that cover. You know, I was just pushing them, one, because I wanted it to be great, and two, because I wanted it to be great. And I have to hand it to Jack is that I'm not sure that this was his original concept. I mean, he could have signed all of these bands at one time, but he went with it. He trusted me, and as a result, nearly half a century later, me and you are talking about what is essentially an oldies album, which is kind of funny. My two influences for that were those kind of golden group albums where you have guys in motorcycle jackets, like Paragons Meet the Jesters, and there was a Golden Gassers, and there was a series on Mr. Maestro Records, just, you know, the hits of the day. Plus, I loved Yazoo Records, the blues label that Nick Pearls ran. So that's, you know, it's like Blues of Southeastern Georgia, 1927 to 33. And so it was kind of like an intellectual gathering of material along with this kind of pop sensibility. And I do believe that you know, I had the pick of the litter. I didn't invent any of these records. I don't even think I was especially prescient, because this music was ready to be rediscovered. It had reached that point where, oh yeah, 5 years ago was nothing, but now it's really cool. And, you know, in the cyclical generations of rock and roll. And
essentially you also had first press of it as well. It's just like the olive oil. You want the first press of the olive oil.
That's exactly. No, I had first pick. And there was a lot of things also I couldn't get. I couldn't get 96 Tears. I still think that Talk is on the record, but I realized they turned me down too, the Music Machine. You know, I was just taken from what they were able to get. And over the year and a half that they got, you know, my idea of it developed. I mean, some of those records were, what, 4 years old, 5 years old when I started? So 3 years old. So it was a continual. I mean, I thought the songs on there were really different from each other. But actually, in hindsight, they have a similar personality. I mean, you know, Sagittarius is very different than The Seeds, which is very different than, I don't know, Amboy Dukes or Blues Project. I saw the differences there, but now I see that, you know, with the long lens of distance, it's pretty amazing, and it moves on.
Were you able to get the master tapes for most of those, or were some of them pulled directly from records?
I think we got master tapes for most of them. I don't remember too much about it, but I think, you know, they had to track down a lot of these people too. And a lot of the bands, when they tracked it down, said, oh, Elektra, well, we'd like you to sign our new stuff. I mean, the guy who really made it happen was this guy, Michael Kapp, who is the son of Mickey Kapp of Kapp Records. And he was a lawyer, and he just really worked hard getting these rights. I mean, now, of course, you put together an album and there's whole divisions of record companies that have the wheels greased for licensing. But, you know, really kind of a fascinating way. But again, the stars were aligning. I'm a rock writer at the time. I played once with Patty in 1971. In fact, there's a funny letter that Greg Shaw's widow sent to me, where from January of 71, and we're talking about Nuggets, and I'm saying, yeah, I'm hoping to change the name to Rockin' and Reelin' USA. I'm so thankful Jack Holtzman said no. I mean, geez. And then in the next paragraph, I say, and next week I'm doing something really strange. I'm backing up a poet at St. Mark's Church. And I look at this letter from January 71, and I think, this is exactly where my life turns. This is the moment where I move into my future. It's pretty amazing. You know, I mean, I think at that time, I was hoping that the Nuggets would be like city-oriented, you know, like the bands of L.A. and the bands of
Chicago.
Exactly, you know. But Elektra just didn't want to get that deep into it at this point. They wanted a one release, and so that's how it happened. And
there seems to have been an open-mindedness in the record companies back then that was rather unique to its day.
Well, I think Jack Holtzman was. I would say that he was an unusual record company president at best. You know, he had a sense of vision, artistic vision, a sense of adventure. You know, he wasn't Columbia. He wasn't, you know, one of the majors. They still had a sense of themselves as independent. And that's great, because that's why Elektra, especially in the 1960s, I would buy every Elektra record that came out before I even heard anything about it, because I knew that whether I would like it or not, it had a sense of quality and personality. And, you know, I was so proud when I could actually walk up to the Elektra offices and, you know, hang out. But, you know, he was very broad-minded. I have the ad of the trade ad of the original Nuggets, and half of it is Nuggets and half of it is the new Harry Chapin record. So
tell me a little bit about that conversation, trying to convince him to keep the Stooges for record number 3.
I went to see the Stooges at the Vanity Ballroom very early when I was a talent scout. And, you know, I love the Stooges. You know, they were fucked up. Bill Harvey, who is Jack's vice president, hated them. And they, you know, there was drugs and Ron Ashton walking around their Stooge house in a Nazi uniform. And you know, they just turned it down. I also tried to get them to put out the Stork Forest album, which the group became Blue Oyster Cult. Sandy Perlman immediately called me up. And I liked the Stork Forest because it was a little more light and progressive, you know, progressive. And then I brought them a couple, you know, I brought them a country band called Sandy River. They didn't like them. I brought them the Sidewinders, which was a genre, would be known as power pop, I guess. The record actually finally came out on RCA. But they didn't really seem to like, and, you know, they're giving me tapes. And, you know, I just remember one of the tapes I got was Daryl Hall and John Oates' demo tape. Nah, I don't like this. I didn't. I mean, you know, given the type of music I like, it's not my thing. Mm-hmm. So, but like I said, the record that I did get to do for them has lived a half a century, which is crazy.
Yeah. Were you surprised, or are you surprised at the longevity and the reception of it?
Astonished. I mean, you know, the fact that people come up to me all over the world, in Australia, among other places, and tell me how Nuggets influenced them and what it meant, you know, it's remarkable for now. You know, if you think of when Nuggets came out, if we were talking about a Nuggets type record that was nearly a half a century old in 1972, we'd be back in 1922. Mm-hmm. So that's an entire lifetime. Mm-hmm. But you know, and what happened, of course, is that garage rock, as it wasn't called garage rock then, is really kind of the grassroots of the impulse to make music. I think I caught that, you know, this sense of, I think of it as a sense of desire in these bands to become. And I associate it with myself because that's what I was like. Mm. In a weird way, that album is kind of like an autobiography of my late teens and early 20s when I wanted to be one of those bands. Never really, you know, got there, and then helped figure out the blueprint for what the bands would be wanting to do when rock and roll came down off its excessive era and brought it back down to what we call punk rock now. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the CBGB's bands, Television in particular, they were doing songs that were on Nuggets, Count Five song, or, you know, Music Machine. Us as well. I mean, what is a greater Nugget than Gloria? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the national anthem of garage rock. That's beyond.
The Nuggets compilation to me really captures this period of democratization of music instruments and the desire to be a pop star. And it captures the energy of these bands. And you know, there was a half a dozen in every town.
Absolutely. And they're more sophisticated than you would think. I've played in a lot of Nugget tribute nights over the years. Mm-hmm. In fact, me and Tony Shanahan, the bass player with Patty these days, we're planning a 50th anniversary Nuggets concert somewhere in the universe. But you start taking these songs apart and they're not like, oh yeah, three chords and we're off. You know, they have moves, they have cool hooks. They're just, you know, it's a really fascinating genre. And the fact that it has made such an impact psychically. I mean, you know, because I believe rock and roll or any music needs to sometimes bring itself back to its common denominator. Mm-hmm. And the impulse to begin. And somewhere in a garage somewhere, might be, you know, the rock and roll band I know, but some kid sitting there with a sampler and, you know, manipulating sound electronically and participating in the music of his or her moment. Mm-hmm. And I really love that. I feel the same thing, say, when I listen to bebop of the 40s, the excitement of these musicians finding a new way to perform, you know, and you can just see the energy and the arc of what it will be when, sooner or later, 5 or 10 years later, it transmutes because it's gotten too abstract. And so then you have I think of music sometimes as a spiral staircase. You know, you start here, it goes up and up and up and up and up and up, and then it starts returning to where it was, but you're up a level. And, you know, that's, I mean, you can look at grunge over garage rock and see that the impulse is the same for Nirvana as it was maybe for the Seeds, but there's a whole different sensibility and surrounding for it. And it's, and it builds, it's kind of a continual, you know, thing. I mean, personally, I don't know whether rock and roll will have another one of those moments. To me, you, everything that's been possible with an electric guitar has been done at least three times over. And maybe the soundtrack of the 21st century, even now, rock and roll sounds somewhat dated. That said, I don't mind. I mean, musics have lifelines, you know, blues. They'll be great interpreters of rock and roll, but the innovators, the that I think the innovation is done. Just like there's great blues players, but no one's going to be doing anything different from the blues.
Yeah.
You know, it's been over here, it's been electrified, it's been taken up here, it's been, but all of a sudden you realize that everything that's possible within a music, the lifetime of the music, has been explored. And now, yeah, welcome the new, whatever that new is.
Well, especially with those instruments. I mean, the drums, the bass, the guitar. To me, that combination is like Mexican food. It's the same ingredients folded differently.
Exactly, exactly. A little hot sauce in the right place.
And that's fine, because every day, at least once, I want a burrito. So that's fine.
Oh, yeah. We love them.
So as an artist, do you find it difficult to listen to records and stay objective without trying to pick them apart?
I'm very lucky as an artist because I have two halves of my brain that I can move between. I have the analytical, historical sensibility. I'm a writer. I can look at a piece of work, think how it works, all that stuff. But as a musician, I short circuit that. I play totally by feel. To be honest, I'm not, like I said, I don't read music. That's why I can improvise well. I can feel it without analyzing it in my head. Simple as that. I mean, I enjoy music because I dig it, you know. I like to dance. Mm-hmm. If you see me in Sydney dancing to White Wedding at 3 o'clock in the morning, I am having a good time, you know. And if I want to dissect White Wedding and figure out what's great about it, so many great things, including Steve Stevens' rhythm parts, which I've stolen many times. But you know, I can enjoy and listen and appreciate music without thinking about it.
That first single that you made with Patty, Hey Joe, The story of that, that was all self-funded as well. Is that right?
Yeah. Robert Mapplethorpe gave us $1,500 to do it. I was familiar with record stores pressing records from my experiences in the oldies shops, where they all had this kind of a cappella music that would appeal to doo-wop collectors in a tri-state area. So Times Square Records did it. The Relic Rack had their label. Some of it was reissues of rare records. Some of it, they would get, you know, some groups on the corner and stick them in a studio. But I thought that, you know, I could do this. I could get a record, get it pressed, and sell our 1,500 copies through Village Oldies, through the bookstores. You know, we carted them around and left them at places. And, you know, some, most of the time, never went back to pick up any sales figures. You know, put an ad in the same way that I bought the MC5's Looking at You back with Borderline. I sent $1 to Trans Love Energies in Detroit, in Ann Arbor, and got the MC5, their self-pressed 45. So, you know, we knew we could get like a little blurb and cream or something, or a little review. And if you send, you know, $1 or $2 to Mayor Records, you know, you'd get in the mail. Patty would autograph the sleeve, and we sold it. Mm. It was more an experiment to see whether this magnetism that we were generating live, people had no idea where we were. We have a piano player, a guitar player like me, scrubbing rhythm, Patty in the middle, you know, hallucinating poetry. There was nothing like us, and we didn't know what the heck we were either, but this was this, we knew that people's attention was on us when we played. And that was so, I was curious to see whether we could get that on a record. And for 3 hours, which was all we could afford, Electric Lady in the back room, you know, we did Hey Joe, and we had 15 minutes left over, and we did Piss Factory. I took it to Philadelphia to a pressing plant. Took them a while to do it. When I got back, I looked at this, at the record head on, and I saw they used really cheap vinyl. That's how I can tell if it's a bootleg or not these days, because the bootlegs were always really nice vinyl. But if you look, it's gray side on. So I knew that what they did was
you got the reground.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, but it got out there, and it was a way for us to hear what we sounded like. And again, just like Nuggets, the fact that Patty and I are still making music, that we've seen the world, that we continue to push our own boundaries. You know, she's very demanding. She don't want to repeat herself. And so, and she's pushed me to keep on improving myself, which is a great blessing.
It's a great partnership. So you mentioned 1,500 of those records were pressed.
Yeah.
And I imagine probably for the first year, you guys had boxes of them around the house.
Boxes and boxes, yeah.
When did you finally clear them out?
I don't remember. I mean, you know, we had them up at our manager ran a publicity firm up in Times Square in a back room. So maybe some of them were there. Mm-hmm. You know, who knows? By then, of course, that came out in the summer of 74. By a year later, we were signed to Arista and preparing our first album and actually getting a real drummer for the first time. Mm. So, you know, you don't really look back. I should have grabbed the box sooner or later, but, you know, who knew? It was just like, you know, stuff.
Yeah. Those records are now worth several hundred dollars each. So
yeah, I'm sure, but again, you got to make sure it's the real one because, you know, I went to France and Mark Zermati at Sky Dog Records, you know, he says, "Hey, do you want a copy of Hey Joe? I just pressed up some." I said, "Great." But like I said, the real one, you know, the bootlegs are really like nice vinyl. You know, you can look at them and think, "Oh, this is really good." Yeah.
So your record collection, I imagine you spend several hours a day in front of the record player enjoying your collection, yeah?
Well, you know, it depends on what I'm doing. I mean, sometimes I'd rather listen to radio because, you know, you get the serendipity. I mean, look, here it is. Let me show you. Ooh. What is known as the music room.
Holy moly, look at that.
Yeah. And I mostly the 45s are upstairs because I really been meaning to sort them over the years.
But, do you have more 45s than LPs?
About the same. I mean, I've never really counted them, but I imagine I have about 3,000 of each. Mm. And, you know, CDs. And I went through a little 78 period when I did my book on the crooners of the 1930s. You call it Madness. Definitely a strange tangent, which I got really obsessed about. But, I mean, at this point, I'm trying to winnow them because, you know, my daughter, she says, better not leave me all them. But every time I take it out, I just like these records, you know. So the ones that actually move on are just ones I have in there that some of them I haven't even opened, you know.
Right.
Or some of them I think I should. You know, I was going through and I saw that Petrol Emotion. I never listened to this record. What do they sound like? And, you know, maybe they're great. Hours of fun. That's what I have to say.
Do you have them somewhat organized where you could find whatever you're looking for right away?
I'm pretty good with the albums. The albums are kind of in vague categories, you know, jazz, country, western, reggae, African blues, you know, oldies. Mm-hmm. So I can pretty much find, except the overflow on the floor is really, this needs to be done something with.
Are you precious about records being a first pressing or not?
I don't really mind, if it is, but I'm not going to pay a premium. I want the music. You know, I like to look at an original label, but I went through that at Village Oldies where, you know, the difference of $150 for a record is like, you know, Christ, I don't care. You know, especially now, I mean, I've done some DJing, you know, Nugget C type DJing or, and, you know, a lot, or Northern, you know, like dance songs from the 60s. And, you know, that Northern Soul thing is like, oh, yeah, it's, yeah, you call it Northern Soul and you've added, you know, three times its value. And I just like the records, and sometimes a lot of them are booted, so I'll just put that in my box. I mean, the unfortunate thing is I'll get a record and maybe I'll listen to it five times and then it disappears into the piles, mm-hmm. you know, unless I happen to be really into it or it becomes part of a research project that I do, you know, so. Mm. But I got a pretty good box of stuff. And, you know, I've been going around here in Pennsylvania and they have these auction houses where you buy like 60 records and maybe 50 of them or 55 of them are, you know, the usual crap, and a couple of them blow your mind. So mm-hmm. I do that, you know. They just come here.
How do they go, though? Do you have a local record shop you take them to?
I should. I actually have a little stall in an antique mart, and I've been bringing some of them down and putting them there. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes they go, and sometimes it's like having a storage space with price tags on.
Can you remember every record you have? Like, for example, maybe not every record, but when you see a record on a shelf that looks very interesting, do you know if you have a copy or not?
I'm pretty sure most of the time that I know it's passed through me. Sometimes I can't find it. Sometimes I have a desire to buy a record that I already have and know I have just because I love the thought of buying it. Or I try to buy it and send it to somebody who I like. Yeah, you know, I kind of vaguely know. I'm pretty good with the albums. The singles are such a mess, I have to say. But I've been, you know, one of these days this winter, I'm going to take over the whole house. I'm going to start sorting them, get it together, because trying to find a single in there is a mess.
They're all in sleeves, or they're not in stacks, or they're not in the bathtub yet, right?
Not in the bathtub yet. They're mostly in sleeves. Every once in a while, you have a tragedy, like the box that I was keeping my picture sleeves in. There was a jug of water on the top, and whatever happened, the jug started leaking. I didn't realize that. And then one day I went there, and they were all like soaked and, you know, molded and, you know. Mm. Things get lost. I had a flood in the basement about 10 years ago, and the bottom drawer that I had a bunch of records in got, you know, whacked. But it doesn't seem to have made a dent.
you just get more.
You know, they're great things to have. You know, everybody thinks that their record collection is more valuable than it probably is. I remember seeing on YouTube once this guy with a Swing 78 collection, 100,000 records, all filed and, you know, noted file cards. And he was trying to sell it for like some huge amount of money. And I'm thinking, who's going to buy it? I mean, you know, it's, mm-hmm. you know, it's one of those genres that perhaps is not happening. I mean, for a long time, R&B vocal groups, you know, you could see the prices plummeting, especially as the core collectors pass on. You know, rockabilly records seem to have retained their worth. Garage records, pretty much. But every once in a while, especially as the formats change, I mean, 78s, except for, you know, your blues lunatics and stuff, they're not as valuable to, you know, collectors, because they're just hard to play and they're hard to manipulate. You know, it's funny that the vinyl thing has come back, singles and especially albums, because, you know, who knew? I mean, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of kids don't care about vinyl albums and probably won't in a few years. But, you know, then you think about something like the Universal Fire that destroyed all those masters, and you realize part of what you're doing is preserving the music in some way, shape, or form. So some lunatic can come into my stall and, you know, say, man, look at that, there's that Jerry Southern record I've been looking for, it's the one I need. I mean, you don't know what tickles people's innards.
Do you have a holy grail or something that you'd love to be able to find on vinyl?
Mm-mm. I really don't. At this point, I'm total serendipity. I usually like to go to the local record fair, smoke a joint in the car. I'll walk in there and I'll say, what is today's theme? And, you know, because really I have most of any genre I was into, most of the stuff I need, you know. You find a really fun Charlie Parker 10-inch, it'd be nice, but there's nothing, there's no album that I have. There's one single which I'm dying to get, and I will pay a lot of money for it because I think it's one of the greatest songs ever. I was researching this group and I came on it. It's by a group called The Webs, and the song is It's a Hard Habit to Break. And it's an amazing thing, and I went on eBay, and it's going for like, $150. Yeah, I'm not going to, it would be fun to do, and if I ever, get a weird royalty check and feel like, whoop-de-doo, maybe I'll try to get it. But, if I don't have it, that's okay. But I would really like to find that record because that's a really good one.
Now, out of your entire collection, I imagine you probably have at least a handful of records that mean a lot to you. I don't mean the ones that are worth the most money, but the ones that are the most precious to you. Which ones are those?
I mean, it's funny. I don't know what records I would grab if the house was collapsing. I've had fun collecting stuff. I really like, Lynn Cromwell, Hollywood 1107. I've enjoyed collecting the ones around it on that label. It's a pretty weird label, no hits, but a lot of some blues, some weird instrumental stuff. I don't know how they came up with Lynn Cromwell. The ones that mean the most to me, I have to say, are the Patty records, the ones that we did, because that's my contribution to, the universe. It really depends on what I'm into at the time. And I've passed through so many musics that in the end, and you get spoiled too, because, at this point in time, having the real record, I mean, I have two Elvis Sons on a 45, which I bought from Danny Mims, who was in the Flamin' Groovies. I have a couple weird, records that are some of my favorites. Stickball, the triple X rated record by P. Vert. That's always a good one. I really love the records from the Times Square Records label for that Slim put out from the store, including the Multicolor Stormy Weather by the Five Sharks. Not the Five Sharps, the real one. He got together a group and called them the Five Sharps. So I like those. I have boxes of fun stuff. And what I really like are the records I take with me to DJ. I have like two 45 boxes. I've DJed in Sydney and Melbourne last time we were in Australia. And it was really fun, So that's my like little box of records. But they're all precious to me, and there's nothing there that is so crazy rare, or that it's a practical collection. It's a functional. It's there to be played, and I just like it as a whole. And just going through it, I often do this thing where I close my eyes and walk up to thing and pull out something and see what it is. And, usually it's, something I really, I'd like to hear again and might not hear again for another 20 years. I have my favorites, Quicksilver Messenger Service, just to name one off the top of my head. But, I always like to have a copy of, Happy Trails with me wherever I go.
Any records that like an artist friend of yours that may not be amongst us anymore that handed to you, and something that contains a great memory?
I at this point I have a lot of great artists that have handed things to me. A lot of them, it's my friends, I love Kevin Kinney from Driving and Crying. So I have, his solo stuff, his Broken Hearts and Auto Parts record is one of my favorites of all time. I mean, I have a lot of people who I appreciate, and if they're not with us any longer, then I can only appreciate them more. Johnny Thunders. I love Johnny Thunders. And, you know, I have a bunch of his crazy records that, you know, people put out, his live performances, picture discs, you know. It's kind of, I've never been good at these questions because I'm not a person that has a top 10. I have a top thousands, just depending on where I'm at in the thing. My daughter always says, you got to have a favorite movie. And I said, I don't know. After the Ten Commandments, what else is there? But I believe music exists in the present tense. And so the record that I'm listening to at that moment, that's my favorite record. It's kind of, it's a sweet way to look at your record collection. And then, you know, when I'm driving along and some record that I'm crazy about, whether I like the entire group or not, you know, doesn't matter. You know, it's when a great record comes on, you are transported. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, I mean, depending on what I'm doing, I have a lot of 12-inch disco things that I accumulated in the early 80s, which I love, you know, weird ones from Italy and stuff. And like I said, you come over to my house and it's just a little bit of everything, which is what I like. I know I'm known for garage rock, but I'm into great records. And so I don't care. I love my reggae records. Actually, the 45s I have of 70s reggae are just really precious to me. Mm. You know, so come on over and I'll spend whatever you like.
Well, I do appreciate the time you spent with us. I want to suggest next time you get down to Sydney, you let us know. And I'll take your record shopping. We'll smoke a J outside, and then we'll let the universe provide.
And I'll say, well, what is this? Oh, my goodness. This is a whole new tributary that I've never even thought of.
Oh, Australia had this wonderful, I mean, you know better than anyone. Australia had this wonderful parallel scene with the U.S., with the scientists and Radio Birdman. And
oh, yeah. I know Dennis Tech. Mm. We play Radio Birdman. I have a show on Sirius. I don't know if you have Sirius in Australia. Sirius XM Satellite.
No. No, it's just the U.S.
Okay, yeah. So, you know, I mean, it's just great. I love the way music brings people together. That's really kind of amazing and very heartful. And it seems to erase national boundaries. When I was in, we played in Israel about year 2000, and listening to the radio, you know, you'd hear Israeli music, then you'd hear Arabic music. And if you didn't know that the language was slightly different, it was the same song. Hmm. And I often think that all these warring factions, if they just listened to each other's music, the world would be a better place. Simple as that. And that's what I, you know, try to do. I'm not nationalistic about any music. You know, you come over to my house, we'll sit down and listen to, you know, great country music, strange jazz. You know, and we can follow George Jones with the Art Ensemble of Chicago. That's the range. And that's the range which we liked with Patty too. You know, we didn't want to be one genre. We didn't want to be able to be defined. We wanted to be able to do a quick song with a great chorus and we could dance to. And then we wanted a field of exploratory sound on sound like Radio Ethiopia. We want that spread because that's the kind of music we listen to, essentially.
All right. Well, Lenny, again, thank you so much for your time. I really do appreciate it. And we'll see you when you get down under, right?
That's great. Like I said, we're scheduled to play whenever the next big day out is. I think it might be March. I don't remember. Wow. But, you know, unless a miracle happens, it might be the following year. Yeah. I mean, who knows? Or it might be never, or it might be sooner than we hope. I really miss playing. It's always been my meditation and my emotional release and communication with the people. And of course, Patty is about as righteous as a human can be. Mm. So we're just hoping to be able to come down to Australia and, you know, have a great time. And we'll see you there.
You got it. Thanks again, Lenny. Much appreciated.
My pleasure. Take care, Nate.
All right. Cheers. Bye-bye. Ah,
there we go. Mr. Lenny K. If you guys enjoyed this conversation, there is more of it up at patreon.com/vinylguide. Join our community up there. You get access to all sorts of extended interviews and more. And also, don't forget to check out the book Mind Over Matter, The Myths and Mysteries of Detroit's Fortune Records. Just Google it up and grab a copy. It is a beautiful book. Again, thank you so much, Lenny, for all your contributions and for coming on The Vinyl Guide. And that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Again, happy 2021. Thanks to everyone who shares these episodes on social media, talks to their friends about what we talk about here on the show. We appreciate everyone who does that sort of stuff. Also, please feel free to leave us a positive review on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever. Log in, give us 5 out of 5 or 10 out of 10, wherever else. Maybe Spotify. I think you could rate on Spotify as well. Even Amazon Podcasts or Google Podcasts. Wherever you get this show, leave us a positive review. That would be super duper helpful. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.